Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Curious Advantage podcast. This series is about how individuals and organizations use the power of curiosity to drive success in their lives and businesses, especially in the context of our new digital reality. It brings to life the latest understandings from neuroscience, anthropology, history, business, behaviorism, about curiosity, and makes these useful for everyone. My name is Garrick Jones, and I'm one of the co-authors of the book, The Curious Advantage. And today I'm here with one of my other authors, Simon Brown. And we're delighted to be joined by Philippa Neave. Hi, Philippa.
Hello.
Philippa is an activist and a connector and a consultant and a journalist and a project manager and a writer-editor and a senior advisor on the UN's Lexicon of Electoral Terminology. And we're going to ask more about that in a moment. But Philippa is an expert in electoral assistance, journalism, and public outreach. And we are very curious about all she does and what she knows. And it's an honour to welcome you to the Curious Advantage podcast, Philippa.
Well, it's an honour for me to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
We're really pleased to have you with us so that we can have a conversation about some of the things you do and some of the things you know about context and language and visualization and working with young people and going into completely curious new situations. Is it correct to say that you're an expert in working with young people in difficult environments? And perhaps you could tell us some of the most memorable programs that you've run.
Yes, I think it's very fair to say that that I do focus on young people, but not only. Sometimes it's also we're reaching into marginalized groups and we're having to target individual types of, you know, sections of the population who are not getting access to information and things like that. But for the most part, young people are very much the, you know, the biggest target of our work because they're the future. And if young people don't participate in rebuilding their country, because it's what it's about usually in these contexts, then if the young people are not behind it, you know, you're nowhere. And in fact, to answer your question about one of the most memorable things that happened in this kind of work was in Tunisia. As you know, we've just had the 10th anniversary of the Tunisia Revolution. And after the revolution in Tunisia, the United Nations was asked to come and deploy an election assistance mission to assist the transitional authorities to organize the first democratic elections ever in the country. And that's what we do. And because there's no institutional memory of how you run an election, we are these election technicians who come in. So I was faced with a situation. We've got a very young population in Tunisia. And amongst that population, the election, the word election, was actually a dirty word. Why? Because under the previous dictator, under Ben Ali, an election meant that he was getting 99.8% of the vote, and it just wasn't an election. So the young people were disgusted, you know, with the political class, and just with even the word election was difficult. So that was the first thing, was to see how can we overcome this reluctance of young people to even believe that actually change is possible, to believe that an election can be something that's actually worth taking part in, and that this time around it's going to be different. So there was a huge sort of trust gap, you know. And we, the election teams, the election assistance teams, we're very much in the background. You know, we assist the authorities, but we're not at all visible to the general public. You know, our work happens in a very quiet sort of way. So I was spending time trying to understand what would be the best way to reach young people. And of course, as we all know, music is one of the best possible ways in which you can communicate with people in general, but with young people in particular. And so I thought, right, I think what we need to do is to perhaps use music and have a song, or have a song that really can, you know, can address these issues that these kids are facing. You know, huge challenges. You know, youth unemployment, things like that. You know.
So you're talking about using tools around music to build up trust with these young people. How did you do it?
Well, I thought I have to. The young people themselves have to create this music. It's not me who's going to come along with a song and say, "Hey, listen to this." No, it's how can we make a song? How can we find some kids who are motivated? And in this particular case, I was extremely, extremely lucky because I met a woman who had had a massive career in the music business, and she had retired to Tunisia. And she, yeah, I met her socially actually, and I said, "Oh gosh, yeah." She produced some massively, massively famous people. I'm not going to talk about it because she's very discreet, but you know, very famous bands that everybody knows. And so I thought, gosh, you know. And I said, "Please, would you ever help me? I'm not a music producer, but I really want to do a song." And so finally, I managed to persuade her. And together we were looking around, and there were quite a lot of young people already doing songs themselves, you know. So we thought, oh, what's going on? And actually the problem was that the political parties were already grabbing hold of these young people. And so then they were already having a political colour that we could not possibly use. So we thought, what are we going to do? She says, "There's only one thing to do. We're going to go underground." It's like, ah, okay. And then it was over to her, and she literally found, you know, this great band of rappers who lived in a garage, literally. And then we basically put together a group of young Tunisians of different musical styles, and they composed this song. And she was not at all an institutional person. And she said, "I'm not even going to allow you to give me any key words. You Amazing. Have to trust this. You have to trust the kids." Seriously.
And it had a huge impact, I can imagine. I mean,
massive. Became an anthem. Wow. It was amazing. I mean, I think we benefited a great deal from her experience, but sure. also from the talent of these young kids. It was amazing. They're still playing it 10 years later.
Fantastic.
It's amazing. It reminds me when Paul Simon was brought in, and he found all these incredible indigenous and black artists and musicians, and created alongside them Graceland, that Graceland album. Right. And it went global, and it was a global hit. But what it had the impact of doing was kind of raising the consciousness of the entire country, no matter what color people were, to say our music is legitimate and it's valid and it's loved by the world. And that single act had a huge impact on the kind of identity of South Africa in the world. It was amazing. And the power of music, it just reminds me about what you were doing in Tunisia. But what other tools do you develop and use?
Well, it depends on context, actually, Garrick. Yeah. It really does, because you can find yourself. I mean, Tunisia was a pretty sophisticated environment. I mean, apart from in the countryside, most people can read and write, you know. And you had quite a developed advertising industry and so on. So you can work with those kind of tools quite easily. I mean, if you've got advertising agencies, you can go to them and say, "Do me a TV spot," you know. But when you go into other locations that are, for example, I'll give you a couple of examples. One was Southern Sudan. Now, Southern Sudan is, if not the poorest, it's certainly one of the poorest countries in the world. It was suffering from the backlash of the longest war in Africa, 21 years of war. And they were getting ready to vote for their independence. There was going to be a referendum. Now, Southern Sudan is a country that's about twice the size of France. It has, at the time when we got there to prepare the referendum, it had something like 7 kilometres of paved road in the entire country, that including the landing strip of the airport. So, you know, you're looking at, and then half the year it rains, so that it's mud everywhere. They have 132 languages. I mean, wow. And you had a totally traumatized population because they'd been through the horrors of 21 years of war. So in that kind of context, it's extremely, extremely difficult. What's more, the level of illiteracy was 80% plus, and there wasn't a single printing press in the whole country.
So what do you do?
You couldn't print anything.
Which, so, how did you solve that one? Because I watched your TED Talk, actually, in preparation for this, and I was fascinated to see some of the ways that you addressed it. So I'd love for you to tell us more.
Well, Sudan was very complex. So what I did was I actually went into the traditional, tried to discover what are the traditional ways that people share information across these vast stretches of land and jungle and stuff. How do they share information? They've got to be doing it somehow. Well, yes, they do. They've got the chief, and they've got literally got a guy who runs through the jungle carrying a message to the next settlement. They literally do that. So I was like, okay, so that's what we're going to do. But how do you then guard against message distortion? Because did the person who's carrying the message really understand the message? Because you're coming up with new concepts and stuff. And while he's running across the jungle, he could also, forget the message or maybe transform the message because he's got an agenda, maybe. So, there are lots of really challenging things like that. So then there was the way to perhaps do that was to actually get together with there was a sort of council of chiefs. And so through the Council of Chiefs, you were able to persuade the chiefs to, help spread the message and try and guard against message distortion. But, it was extremely, extremely challenging.
But you're using the resources that are there in the system and in the network already.
Yes. I also worked with a local group that was down in the south of southern Sudan. They'd done quite a bit of work with refugees and people on things like, post-traumatic violence and things like that. And they had used puppets, and they made their own puppets because they were able to address very sensitive issues of tribal animosity and things like that through puppets, because of course the puppet then is not a human, and so you can actually get the puppet to say things that another person would not be able to say. So I went down to see them, and, they were making their own puppets out of scrap and whatever they could find, and they were very effective. So that was also trying to harness the local resources and support them, rather than me coming up with some kind of sophisticated idea that's unworkable.
And can you tell us a bit about how you used language as well, and the role that language played? Because I heard you talk about how if people don't have a word for something, then they can't imagine it. Or you talked a moment ago around sort of election being a dirty word in Tunisia. So what role have you seen language playing, and how have you used that in the work that you've done?
Well, it's massive. The role of language is absolutely critical, of course, because, the choice of word can send this or that message. And if you choose the wrong word, you could send people down a completely erroneous, path of thought that may lead them to completely, the wrong conclusions. So you want to be exceedingly careful. When developing these public information campaigns, it's the choice of words is absolutely vital. So if I don't actually personally speak the language, usually I work in countries where I speak the language, Mm-hmm. So I've never really attempted to do a public information campaign in a country where I don't have command of the language.
Although 132 languages in Sudan would have been quite impressive.
I was just coming to that. In this case. But even also because in a lot of countries you have local, minority languages and so on. So obviously you cannot. But so then what you do is you make sure that you rely on surrounding yourself with individuals who do speak those languages. And basically you have to road test everything, because I can come up with a really snappy, nice phrase, but in somebody else's language, it can have a very different connotation, and you can end up in a lot of trouble. You can end up insulting people or something without even realizing it.
And we found that even with our exploration into curiosity, that when you translate curiosity into other languages, the meaning changes a little. So into German, it goes into neugierig, which is more, or it has connotations of sort of nosiness and busybody and that side of things, which is very different to sort of how it is in the English language. So,
indeed.
Amazing the changes that you see.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, it's very difficult. And so in some countries, you know, you obviously then, some countries like we, that have those multiple languages, obviously you have to work with the people, you know, who are speaking those languages. In southern Sudan, they had a radio station that broadcast out of Nairobi that used 8 of the main languages that covered most of the population, actually. So that was also a choice we made to try and work in those 8 languages out of the 132. Yeah.
What about visual languages, Philippa?
Same thing. I mean, exactly the same. You know, you have to, I mean, especially if when I'm working with the United Nations, it's a very much a mindful concern of ours to be inclusive and therefore reach into even the most marginalized communities who have very small minority languages. And we have to try and make that effort. Now, we can't always do it because of budget reasons, or sometimes, you know, you can't record, you know, X number of radio spots in X number of languages because sometimes you've got multiple languages. So we do what we try to do that in the case of Southern Sudan, use the you know, 8 out of 132 languages and attempt to cover a high proportion of the population in that way.
And then talking back about curiosity, so where have you seen curiosity fitting into your experiences? What role does it play for you?
Well, there's two sides to this. I mean, there's the curiosity element that's driven me to end up doing this kind of work. But then there's the curiosity that my work arouses in other people. Mm. And in particular, when you come to a country that's never experienced a democratic process, for example, you'll find that people are, for the most part, extremely curious about all of it. You know, how does it work? Why is it better? You know, they mostly people think it's better, but they don't know why. Mm. So they have zillions of questions that sometimes you don't have the answer to because they are so curious that they're looking into the corners of certain thinking that it never crossed your mind to think about that. So it's challenging. So it's really, really interesting because every time you go into a new context, you're faced with new questions, you know. So that's what keeps it really interesting because every single mission is different.
Can we talk about going into a new context? Can I ask perhaps, have you been able to learn something over the years about how you enter a new context or, you know, when you go into something new, what are the things that you pay attention to, do you think, to lead your way in?
Well, I think perhaps the most important thing, I mean, the most important thing I learned anyway is, you know, I was a student of Arabic, the Arabic language, so I studied Arabic and when I was 20 years old, I arrived in Egypt. I mean, I'd travelled through Europe, but I'd never been outside of Europe at that time. And I arrived in a completely different world. And what was interesting is because I'm, you know, I look like a European, I've got fair skin and fair hair, I stuck out a mile away anywhere in Egypt, anywhere. So immediately I became aware of myself in a way that I'd never been before because, you know, I'm not somebody who really thinks about what do I look like walking down the street. In this case, I really had to. So I was very, because all the eyes were on you, you know. And so I had to be, very quickly I realized that the way you dress is critical and also your behavior, how you interact with people. Of course, having some understanding of, for example, here in this case, the Muslim culture, you know, how you address men and so on is very, you know, important because you don't want to. And if you're too friendly, they think you're, you know, inviting them to a more intimate sort of, you know. So it's very subtle. But and so, you know, I was only 20 years old, but I got it pretty quickly because actually, it's actually quite obvious, but, you know, having spent I spent a year and a half in Egypt and I saw tourists coming along and girls my age wearing, you know, hot pants and no, you know, sleeveless tank tops on the street and then complaining that men were giving them a hard time. Well, they might as well have been naked, you know, to these men. So, you know, there's an awareness that you just build very quickly if you're halfway, conscious about your environment, you know.
A curious culture is a game changer. What does curiosity mean for you? Follow hashtag CuriousAdvantage and join the conversation.
And you were talking about how you connect with people or the questions you may ask. Could you say something a little bit about that personal interaction between people of a very different context?
Well, to continue on the Muslim world experience, because I've had a lot of experience in that part of the world, including I spent 7 months in Afghanistan and, you know, countries outside the Arab world. And what I've discovered is that very often I end up being the only woman in the room. And because I'm a foreigner, I become an honorary man. So I get to do whatever I want. Which is quite amazing, because people often say, gosh, you know, you go off into these Muslim countries, isn't it really hard? No, it isn't. Because as long as you're respectful, as long as you do try and learn the language, because when I arrived in Afghanistan, I didn't speak Dari or Pashto. I mean, I did then learn some, but, you know, you make that effort. And then you dress correctly and, you know, you will be accepted as long as, you know, this, it's about being polite. It's about also listening a lot, I think. It's about listening. And it's about reading people's reactions and being, you know, being mindful that, you know, okay, they perceive you, like I say, I'm an honorary man, they perceive you as a sort of strange creature because you're not a man, but nevertheless, they can talk to you like a man, you know, it's just very, very odd. But then I get to be friends with the women too, see? Because then there's no problem. I go into the women's quarters and I can, you know, hang out with the women and go to the steam bath or whatever, the hammam and things like that. So it's quite interesting to be able to navigate those two worlds because they are separate worlds.
It's interesting because we talk in the book about the importance of understanding context and when that context has changed. So what I was hearing that you described there was very much that if you have enough of the basic understanding of the context, you can survive. And as you grow a stronger understanding of that context, you can then fit in and build the relationships. But as you were describing of the tourists there who maybe didn't have that understanding of the certain fundamentals within the new context that they were, that was what they wore at home, therefore I wear it there. And suddenly you find yourself completely missing the impact that that not understanding that context actually has.
Yes, and I've learned that you can actually insult people without realizing it, you know.
Yeah.
And that's something that I'm very mindful of. I mean, so for example, I worked in 2017, 2018, and 2019 in the Pacific, which was not at all my area, but out I went to the Pacific, and I went to these Pacific islands there's Vanuatu, and then there's the Solomon Islands. And these islands are quite remote, really, and you have a lot of tribal people still there, what they call custom people. So these are people literally going around in grass skirts. I mean, you know, they are. And they live in the trees, and they live completely connected to nature. It's very impressive to see that. And then you come along again, the kids come up to you, and they come up to you, they touch you, and then they run away screaming because they think, you know, you're some kind of strange creature. You know, they've never seen a white person. And again, you know, how can you possibly connect with people who are living, it's such a radically different lifestyle? Well, the answer is you just sit with them. You sit with them and you make eye contact. Because very often, people are afraid of eye contact. You know? And, you know, I always tend to go and sit with the women first, see how it goes with them. You know, and usually it's no problem. They're very curious. I'm as curious as they are, you know? We're curious of each other. And you don't have a shared language, but you can use your hands, you can, you know. I usually carry some kind of food or biscuits or something, and we start sharing food, and that's often a very good way of breaking the ice. And then you can spend an entire day there not exchanging any words, really, because you don't have words in common, but you can exchange a lot.
I'm amazed. I'm very curious about how you ended up in this and what drew you to this métier, if you want.
It's a strange métier. I mean, it's not very well known. But it's actually a culmination. It's actually my third career, really. I started off as a journalist. I was a reporter for quite a number of years. And I was investigative. You know, it was my favorite part of journalism because of the curiosity element.
I
think in another life, I might have been a detective, actually. I could still do that, maybe. And then I moved into in my work as a journalist, I went into many difficult situations and I saw a lot of non-government organizations working on the ground. And I thought, gosh, you know, they're doing some amazing, amazing work. And I thought, you know, instead of observing, why don't I go over to the other side and actually do something about it rather than reporting about it? And the media was already starting to go a bit funny. And so I just thought, right, you know, I'm going to do that. And so I did. And I joined a British charity organization and was with them for 6 years doing development projects. And then it was by the by. It was a very, it was a curious, let's say, coincidence that it was the first Iraqi elections after the fall of Saddam Hussein. Mm. And the UN had put together a massive, massive operation to allow Iraqi exiles to vote in 14 different countries of the world. Gosh. So you can imagine, it was a massive operation. And so they were looking for people who would be able to, you know, help run the polling stations and all of that. And so somebody recommended me because I speak Arabic and things. I was supposed to run, you know, help run the Paris voting facility there. And when my contract came through, it said Dubai, you know. I was like, Dubai? Dubai? And they said, yeah, no, we need Arabic speakers over there, so can you come to Dubai? So that's what I did. And that's when I met a whole big team of people who were very specialized in election assistance. Mm. And that's how it all started. That was back in 2004.
I'm interested in, what do you think the skills that are necessary to do this kind of work? Because clearly it's multidisciplinary, right? But what are some of the things, the must-haves that you found you had, which made you just well-suited for this?
I think in my particular area, of course, yes, it is multidisciplinary and the teams are multidisciplinary. So you have people who are specialized in, you know, legal people who do things like help to write the first electoral law in the country. So they're legal election people. You have legal elections operations people, election logistics people, and then me, the public outreach. And how did the combination of skills in my particular field was that, yes, I had the media experience from the journalism. I also had the experience of working in, you know, developing countries and also had, you know, that openness, if you like, to the world, having traveled quite a lot already through the journalism. So I think it's absolutely vital to be adaptable. I mean, you cannot do this kind of work because you've got to be flexible, you've got to be adaptable, you've got to be able to think on your feet. And you've got to be open to other cultures, ready to do things in a completely different way, because every time you go to a new context, you've got a whole new way of doing things, a whole new way of working. So, you know, and you can be thrown together with a team of people that you've never met before, and you hit the ground running. I mean, we never have enough time.
You mentioned openness. Philippa, can we talk a little bit more about openness? What does that mean to you, and what do you think sits underneath openness and the need for openness?
I think openness is really the willingness to accept that people think differently than you, they eat differently than you, they look different to you, and that you're actually open to looking at that and saying, well, that's interesting. Hey, you know, I've never met this before. And also openness to be open yourself to other people. So, hey, who are you, this different person? Because, yeah, the people are different to me, but I'm also different to them. So how much of me am I going to be giving to them so that I can actually then, they can feel that they can trust who they've got in front of them, that they feel somehow comfortable in the presence of this very strange person? And I think openness is very much about taking that risk of revealing part of yourself. And that would include certain vulnerabilities. So open, being open is actually something that other people can consider a bit dangerous for that reason.
Yes.
So, yes, and I mean, I think, you know, the School of Hard Knocks does tell you when, you know, how open are you going to be.
You're listening to the Curious Advantage podcast, inspired by the book The Curious Advantage, written by Paul Ashcroft, Simon Brown, and Garrick Jones. Subscribe to the podcast today.
One of the things that we talk about is how, as you go through the process of being curious, it actually builds your confidence. And listening to your story and some of the places that you've been, did you find that curiosity and, you know, experimenting, going to new places, trying things out, that did sort of continue in a virtuous cycle to sort of build your confidence the more curious you were?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely, definitely. I mean, I think I've always been curious. You know, as a child, I've always been curious. Yeah, I was curious as a child. And I think I've also been quite fearless. So I think that's one quality that if you're curious, you need to be fearless. Otherwise, you know, you're going to be frustrated. You're curious, but you can't really get that because you're scared, you know. So, I mean, a lot of the things I've done, people are saying, wow, you did that. And it doesn't seem to me to be at all, you know, I'm not, how can I say, impressed that much that, oh, yeah. But other people seem to be. But, you know, so I think curiosity and fearlessness do go together. Some people might consider it reckless. Who knows? But I think not everybody's curious, not by any stretch of the imagination. And I think it's something that either, you know, you can cultivate your curiosity, you know. I've never had to cultivate it because I've never had enough time to explore all the things I want to explore. So if something ends, I'm so ready for the next thing, you see.
And we found that when you're curious, even if, you know, you put it into action, even if that doesn't work, so your experiment going somewhere, it doesn't work exactly the way you thought or doesn't turn out how you want, that still actually helps with your confidence to then try again, be curious in a different direction, try something else, ultimately allow you to do more.
What about failure?
Was exactly where I was going, because in this particular period since the past 12 months, nothing that we had planned to do, how we planned to do it, everything that I personally had planned to do, I'm not talking about my personal life, I'm talking about the project that I'm working on right now. None of it has been possible. I'm working with a team of people. We have had to redesign the project from scratch. We've had to rethink how we're doing it. We're in the process right now of running the first sort of operational side of our project. It's not gone at all the way we thought it was going to go, but
Is that about it not surviving its encounter with the real or the plans once you get into the real situation, or is it because not because you came in with preconceived ideas, but because the situation is changing all the time around you?
Well, it's both things. I mean, actually, the situation is changing all the time. But what you thought you knew, I mean, say, for example, you know, the project I'm working on is involving the Middle East countries, which I do know quite well. However, in the past year, everything's changed. In the way people work, the way people think, the way people operate, you know, everywhere. It's not just...
Of course, yes.
Yeah? So suddenly you're in this new space, and the assumptions that were made in the design of the project turn out to be, you know, sitting on thin air.
Yes. So you're trying to run an election in a difficult situation... under pandemic conditions.
Right now, it's not an election. I'm trying to develop a mass civic education pool, because a lot of what I do is civic education. See, and so you know, quite often found that I'm revisiting a lot of the same issues over and over again in these areas, because it's what we're talking about are the underpinnings of, you know, what is a you know. citizen participation, democratic structures, you know, all of those
civil society.
Civil society. Yeah. So it's the same themes are coming back over and over. And it's also the underpinnings are such like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the Convention against the Discrimination Against Women, you know, all of these things kind of come together. And, you know, every time I'm redesigning some new way of conveying these things. And so the project is all about creating a mass tool that all youth throughout the region of the Middle East can use to learn about all of this. Well, it would be a long story to describe everything about what's changed about the project. But the ultimate goal is to create, we're building a serious game. So
Is it digital?
Yeah, it's going to be on mobile phone. Because everybody's now got a mobile phone and these kids are on their phones all the time. Yes. So it's what's known as a serious game. So a serious game, you know, a game for learning. So it's a game about civic participation and all of this. But I wanted to do it in a participatory approach. Mm. That's to say, work with the young people who are going to be playing this game to actually make it. Okay?
Yep.
And so having to do all of this online instead of in person.
Not easy.
We're going to be doing workshops and hackathons and things like that in person. Trying to do it all online has proved to be very tricky.
I can imagine.
Yes.
I'd like to come back to your own personal curiosity, if I may. And what at the moment is actually, or what at the moment are you curious about?
Well, I am curious about this gaming world because it's a completely new world to me. It's a very steep learning curve, I have to say. I'm working with some outstanding people who are, you know, in their early 30s. And so I'm learning a huge amount from them about what makes them tick, what they are curious about. See, so that's quite interesting because you know, it's a whole new perspective, really. So that's great. So I'm very curious about all of that, and I'm also curious about how I'm going to adapt to this new reality, because I feel it's not going away. It's not like there is no going back to the old thing. So I'm actually quite excited because I feel we're on the threshold of a whole new way of doing things. And, you know, a lot of people are very worried about, you know, social interaction and all of that. And I'm very curious about how social interaction is going to evolve, because it is going to change. It already has changed. Yes. So, you know, how people choose to interact, how social relationships develop and all of that, you know, is going to change. It is changing in front of our eyes.
We were talking about that the other day, just with the children at the dining room table, and they're all becoming more and more conditioned by the games that they're playing online all the time. And so some of the interaction becomes very, very unusual or very unexpected or sometimes delightful, sometimes incredibly rude. But it's a whole different – there are different rules in place, it seems. And I think I'd love to explore more, perhaps a different podcast, Simon, the idea of serious gaming and curiosity and what that means.
Absolutely.
Well, gaming really is brilliant. A whole, you know, a behavioral field is very interesting because, of course, you have, you know, in the high period of video games, you had a lot of, you know, concerns about how young people were becoming desocialized because they were so obsessed by their games that they wouldn't interact with real people. And there's a problem in Japan, for example. You know, they actually have a whole section of the population that's totally
disappeared.
In the zone, you know.
So, but then there's also all this social stuff going on in the games now, which
that's
is a whole different thing.
Which in the context of the pandemic, I was hearing, was reading something the other day around how the mental health for girls has been hit harder than for boys, and massively generalizing, but boys playing more online games was what their research was finding. And it was through the online games that the boys were socializing and interacting with their friends much more and having positive mental health benefits in lockdown when they couldn't go out. So it's interesting research they've done around that.
If there's one thing you would leave with our listeners, what do you think it might be?
I would say that if you have children, it is vital to cultivate curiosity in your children. Just play games with them, stimulate their curiosity, push them out of the nest as soon as you can to go and explore. Because that will give them the strength and the self-confidence to grow in the world. I think it's the best gift you can give a child, I think, is to cultivate their curiosity if they're not naturally curious. That would be the first thing I would say. And the second thing is, if you don't have children, cultivate your own curiosity. This world is so fascinating. I've just moved to a new house and I've got a garden for the first time in my life. I've got all these flowers and plants and nothing about it. And I'm like, oh my God, this is so exciting. See, so everything new should be the cause of something. So cultivate your own curiosity, I think, is also something that we need to do. Yeah.
Philippa, thank you so much. That's been insightful and enlightening and left us with much, much more to think about.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a Curious Advantage podcast. The Curious Advantage book is available on Amazon worldwide. Order your copy now to further explore the 7 C's model for being more curious. Join the conversation at #CuriousAdvantage. Subscribe today and keep exploring curiously.
This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.